Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, how alarmed should we be by Trump's efforts to overturn the election? Courts across the country have thrown out the Trump campaign's challenges, but now the president is calling on state and local officials to intervene. David Rothkopf, former editor of Foreign Policy magazine, has a word to describe it: traitorous. And he says this shouldn't surprise anyone. In a new book, he makes the argument that Donald Trump has betrayed the United States time and again throughout his presidency. He describes the behavior in a new book titled Traitor, A History of American Betrayal from Benedict Arnold to Donald Trump. He joined me Friday morning. David, in your new book, you accuse President Trump not only of corruption and incompetence, but of being a traitor to this country. That's a pretty serious charge.
No question, and I didn't make it lightly. But, you know, when you go and you look at some of the activities of the president and the definitions of betraying the country that have guided us in the past, what he has done certainly crosses the threshold that would have gotten lots of other people described in the same way. So, for example, aiding and abetting a foreign enemy is notably how he started. And throughout his first term of office, not only did he do that, but he rewarded the enemy for rewarding him. He covered up the crimes of the enemy. He took the word of the enemy over the national security personnel, the United States intelligence community and the FBI. And so that alone is a betrayal. And, you know, the president of the United States, unlike you or I, starts his job out by taking an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. If you compound it with serial obstruction of justice or subsequent attempts to use his office to benefit himself at the expense of U.S. national security, the Ukraine case, for example, where he ultimately was impeached, but essentially was seeking to bribe, pressure the Ukrainians into doing something to help him, not the United States, then, you know, he certainly meets a definition. You know, what did Benedict Arnold do? He took some cash and he gave some drawings to the British and he shifted over to their side. And, you know, what has Donald Trump done with our leading overseas enemy? It's very akin to that.
Moving beyond the early days of his presidency to exactly what's going on now, how would you define his efforts at rejiggering what's happened in the 2020 presidential election?
I think there's strong language that should be used here as well. And, you know, just as an aside, I think we need to shy away from using language that's too strong or inflammatory. But when something happens that meets the criteria for using that language, we have an obligation to use the language. What Donald Trump is doing is seditious. It meets the definition of sedition.
What is the definition?
Well, it's working to undermine the United States government in a systematic way. He is trying to disenfranchise voters. He is asserting fraud where none existed. And I say none existed because no one has been able to produce any evidence whatsoever, and those who have looked have found none. Why is he doing it? It's not to benefit the United States. It's trying to disenfranchise American citizens. What could be more contrary to the concept of a democracy than going to large groups of people and saying, I'm going to take away your vote because you voted for somebody I didn't like? And, you know, he thinks that through a variety of court maneuvers, he might well be successful in some regard. Or alternatively, he can throw a cloud over the Biden administration. And that is, of course, bad for the United States, bad for our standing in the world, and again, would be done purely to benefit him at the expense of the entire country.
So what do you believe, considering that you and I are speaking on Friday morning, when in fact he has invited Michigan legislators to the White House, what do you believe his aim is with those people?
I think both you and I have been doing this long enough to have learned it's a bad idea to try and place ourselves inside Donald Trump's head. It's not a place anybody wants to be, but he could have several different motives. His stated motive is to get the Michigan legislature to throw out the results of the vote in Michigan.
But there are hundreds of thousands of votes in Joe Biden's favor. How can he do that?
In a sane world, he can't. In a world in which the facts matter, he can't. But he has led the Republican Party in a direction where the facts don't matter. The facts of COVID don't matter. The facts of climate science don't matter. The facts of Russian intervention in the United States don't matter. He has set up a sort of series of belief tests that make you a Republican. And one of them now is, are you willing to throw aside any credibility you may have had in your career and say, this election for no reason is under a cloud? And that's what he's trying to do. Either it helps him, or alternatively, if he can't overturn the election, then he can go and make the case that he actually won for the next 4 years, and that can help him politically. And it may, in fact, allow him to, you know, what if he were to resign a couple of days before the end of his term and go to Mike Pence and say, you know, pardon me, because, you know, these Democrats stole the election and look what they'll likely do to me. And he'll provide, you know, this as a justification. Is it a justification? No. But if 40-odd percent of the American people believe it is, and, you know, half of Republicans believe that there was widespread fraud, again, no evidence, but if that happens, it works with his base.
Two things I want to ask you about. Even if Mike Pence were to do exactly as you say, even if the president were to resign a few days in advance and ask for Mike Pence to pardon him, that would apply only to federal and not to state crimes, correct?
Correct.
Secondly, do you believe that he can overturn this election?
I think it's extremely unlikely. The reason that it would be very hard for Trump to achieve his goals is severalfold. First, there is no evidence to support his claims in court. However, if he can raise enough questions in the minds of legislatures, they might take the vote away and say, we direct the electors to behave in a certain kind of a way. They don't have unlimited latitude to do that. And were the votes to then be contested and the House and the Senate to look at them, you're likely to get a split decision between the House and the Senate. And in the way the law is written, the governor of the state then has the tiebreak. And the governor of several of the critical states here are actually Democrats, so they're not going to go across. Biden's margin is not so narrow that he would only get to 270 votes and you have to get rid of one state. You have to get rid of several because he's at 306 votes. And in a number of these states, including notably, for example, Georgia, which just recertified all of its votes on Thursday, it's out of his reach. There's a Republican governor, a Republican secretary of state. They have certified the vote. The margin is large enough. He's not going to get it.
And Pennsylvania?
Pennsylvania, the margin is very large. There are a number of Republicans in the Pennsylvania legislature have said they would not overturn it in the legislature. There are Democrats in high positions in the state. It doesn't seem like it's going to overturn. Michigan doesn't seem like it's going to overturn. Wisconsin doesn't seem like it's going to overturn with their challenge to certain number of votes in the urban areas there. But we have to see this in a different light. It's not just, will he be successful in conducting a coup? How much damage will he do to American democracy? how you know, as the world looks at us, what are they going to think? And what is he setting a precedent for in terms of future elections?
How do you answer that question?
Well, I think the United States for 75 years would go out in the world and say we're champions of democracy, and at least theoretically, not always in practice, but at least theoretically, we would support democratic processes around the world. We are as corrupt a democracy as you can imagine right now. And it's not just Trump, you know, it's Citizens United. It's saying that money equals speech, which means that the people with the most money have the most speech. They have the biggest voices. It's voter suppression. It's the Shelby County decision. It's a group of decisions that allow states to gerrymander, which is a grotesquely undemocratic process. It compounds the flaws of the Constitution, which give underpopulated states more votes, and has led to the two most recent Republican presidents getting elected with a minority vote. If the Georgia runoffs go against the Democrats, and both of them go to Republicans, and the Republicans have the majority, that majority will still have 20 million votes behind it, less than the Democratic minority. So we have a government in which the minority controls the outcomes. Because they control the outcomes in the legislature, they also control the judiciary, and it's corrupt, and the president is a lunatic trying to undermine it. So how do we go to the rest of the world and say, now this is how you do a democracy?
Pretty scary stuff, I must say, David. There have been some efforts to hold the president accountable. The Mueller report, for example, the impeachment. Did those fail simply because there are too many Republicans who not only support but believe in Donald Trump?
Well, again, I don't want to speculate as to who supports because they believe it and who supports because it's in their self-interest, because I think there are a lot of people out there who know better. You know, there are plenty of Republicans who were in high positions who came to the conclusion that the subject of the Mueller report, which is the president's collusion with the Russians, pointed to the Russians having something on Trump. Remember, when Bob Woodward's book came out a couple of months ago, he reported on Dan Coats, Republican senator, rock rib Republican senator from the state of Indiana, who was Donald Trump's chosen director of national intelligence. And Dan Coats said, I believe the Russians have something on Donald Trump. So, you know, there's plenty of evidence. It's like the Mueller report. In the Mueller report, let's set aside the collusion. Half the Mueller report was about obstruction of justice. There were literally 1,000 federal prosecutors who said, this is enough to prosecute the president of the United States. There's no question that it's enough. But Bill Barr came out and said, I don't think it is. Now, do you think Bill Barr doesn't believe it is, or do you think it's in his self-interest to promote that point of view?
So why is it in his self-interest? Donald Trump is not going to be there forever.
No, he's not. But first of all, Barr comes at it from an ideological perspective, which he believes that the president, this idea of unitary president, is the executive and should be able to set parameters. And to the extent to which investigations like this succeed, they overreach that and thus weaken the presidency. So he has an ideological foundation for it. But I also think that he has determined that if Trump or somebody like Trump stays in power, if they can hold on to power for the Republicans, it will enable them to change the judiciary, change the laws. And there is no, you know, just as an aside, the United States by the year 2043 will be a country in which the majority of the population are groups that we thought were minorities. The white majority that had existed for all of 240 years of American history will have fallen into minority status. The Republican Party made a bet 20, 30, 40 years ago, you determine when you like, that they were going to play to the fears, the racist fears of that white minority. Well, what do they do since demographic tide is against them? They've got to rig the system. Citizens United, Shelby, gerrymandering, loading up the courts, blocking Democratic attempts to get on the courts, loading up state legislatures. All those things give them an unfair advantage, and it's kind of their last stand. It's the white majority's last stand in America.
And what about people like Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham?
What about them? You know, Mitch McConnell is about power and power and power, and maybe, you know, his family's, you know, financial standing beyond that. But in the Barack Obama book that just came out, Obama talks about a negotiation with Mitch McConnell in which Obama makes a case for McConnell, you know, moving. And McConnell says, "You seem to confuse me with someone who cares." You know, McConnell behind the scenes. And I think, by the way, you know, Joe Biden thinks, oh, well, my old friend Mitch, he's going to be fine to deal with. And I think Joe Biden is going to have a comeuppance there, because the McConnell approach right now is purely exercising Republican power to advance Republican objectives, notably objectives with the judiciary. As far as Lindsey Graham goes,
who started out totally critical of Donald Trump's candidacy, calling him all kinds of names.
I was at an event. I was at a lunch. I actually hosted a lunch in January of 2016 at Davos, a couple hundred people. Lindsey Graham stood up and said, and Lindsey Graham is not a very tall person, so this is relevant. And he stood up and said, "I will be playing in the NBA before Donald Trump is president of the United States." And then proceeded to denigrate Donald Trump for 10 minutes. But, you know, apparently Lindsey Graham's spine was named John McCain. And when John McCain exited the scene, Lindsey Graham, you know, desperately in search of some kind of stronger character to latch onto, latched onto Trump, to his eternal shame. You know, I remember going to parties in Washington, and Lindsey Graham would be, you know, parties hosted mostly by Democrats. And Lindsey Graham would be there as a, you know, sort of the token reasonable Republican. And he is far, far, far beyond reasonable now.
And Lamara Alexander, we have to ask about Lamara Alexander.
Yeah, now Lamara Alexander tweeted this morning with regard to this Michigan thing. And regard to the transition, he tweeted, "If Joe Biden is winning, then we ought to, you know, help him with the transition." Now, that sounds vaguely principled, except for the word "if," you know, because there is no if. He's already won. In any other era, in any other election, it was, you know, it's locked in. It's a done deal. And by adding that "if," Lamar Alexander says, "I too am a member of the unprincipled club." I mean, the only two people who've made even remotely strong statements about this in the past week are Mitt Romney and Ben Sasse. Now, Ben Sasse repeatedly demonstrates that he is not a man of great character on these issues, and he flips around like a weather vane all the time. Romney sort of pops his head up periodically, does some things that are of some virtue, and then says, "But, you know, let's go along. Let's approve these Supreme Court justices. Let's do all the damage that is a consequence of the thing that I'm decrying."
A quick break. When we come back, more of my conversation with David Rothkopf, author of the new book, Traitor, A History of American Betrayal from Benedict Arnold to Donald Trump.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with David Rothkopf. So you're writing a book about traitors in history, and you feel very strongly that Donald Trump belongs among them.
You know, first of all, the reason I did it, I'd written a column about this and somebody came and said, write a book about it. And I thought, well, I could write another one of these books that's a litany of the things that Donald Trump has done. But the problem with that is, and I recommend it against it, anybody try to do this, is that every day there's a new wrong. So the book, you'll never end writing this book, and we're going to discover new wrongs for the next couple of years. So I thought is, why don't we get away from the sort of inflamed conversations of day-to-day politics? Let's just look at it in a historical sense. Let's compare him to the people who betrayed the country in the past. Names that you know, whether it's Benedict Arnold or Aaron Burr, who was tried for treason, or Jefferson Davis, or the spies of the 20th century. What did they do? How did they hurt the United States? And when you then take that and say, here is a president, he began, his original sin was collaborating with a foreign enemy. There is massive amount of evidence, 271 interactions between the Trump campaign and the Russians, 40 meetings, a whole bunch of indictments, Trump calling for the help of the Russians publicly, new evidence emerging that, you know, Roger Stone knew from the Russians about the dump of the WikiLeaks, you know, to offset the Access Hollywood tape. Then Trump embracing Putin, rejecting the FBI, firing Comey, giving the Russians big victories in Syria on intermediate nuclear forces, on a whole set of other things. You know, that alone is a giant betrayal. So was Ukraine. So was COVID. So was saying, I'm going to put my political fortunes ahead of the lives of, so far, 250,000 Americans, possibly by February 28th, 500,000 Americans who will be dead of this thing. So is turning the White House into a piggy bank for his family business and tens of millions of dollars getting directed into his family business, which is the most straightforward kind of betrayal. Kind of betrayal, by the way, that the Constitution says you can't do in either one of the emoluments clauses. You can't take foreign money. You can't take domestic money in addition to your salary as president. There's this long litany. And then you say, he's the president. He did all this as the president. None of these other people who betrayed the country did it from the most powerful position in the country. And that's why when you look at it objectively, set aside the politics, you can come to no other conclusion but that this was the worst betrayal in American history.
David, how much farther can Trump go to maintain his position that this election was illegal or fraudulent?
Well, it depends. There's some big hurdles. If the election is certified and by all the relevant states, and then the Electoral College meets in December and the Electoral College votes Joe Biden, there's nothing Trump can do. So those are the hurdles. Is he going to get certified? And then if he gets certified, will the electors honor the certification and vote the results of the election? Now, if he is able to delay that, to muddy those waters, to bring it to the House of Representatives. You know, in the House of Representatives, when you start voting on outcomes because the Electoral College is taken out of the equation, you vote by state delegations, and there are more Republican state delegations than there are Democrats. So it's not the same as normal vote in the House. Then things get extremely muddy. What's more likely is he loses in the Electoral College vote, but he has laid enough groundwork to say this was a theft. He's got enough conspiracy theories spinning out there that he can say, this was stolen from me and I'm going to run again in 2024, or I'm going to be a factor in the Republican Party to seek justice. I'm going to delegitimize Joe Biden. I'm going to say that and in some ways that's an echo of what happened to him, right? He won. But everybody said the Russians helped you win. This was, delegitimized. And that has haunted him. And I think, and you know, in some part of his dark and twisted psyche, his main objective is that Joe Biden has to live with the stigma that he did. The only difference being, of course, that the Russia hoax wasn't a hoax, and this is a hoax.
What about the changes going on at the Department of Defense and the Pentagon? How much danger do they pose for us between now and January 20th?
Well, there's sort of several levels, I think, of that. On the one hand, you've got the new acting Secretary of Defense saying, we're going to reduce our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan to 2,500. Now, this may sound welcome to anybody who'd like to see us out of those benighted conflicts. But if you reduce the troops without any thought to what's going to come next, the stability, or to their security, you've got a problem. And so what he's doing is he's sabotaging Biden. He's creating a situation that Biden is going to have to actually add troops back into those situations. And then you're going to have a bunch of people going, see, here is Biden, warmongering, blah, blah, blah. And actually what he's trying to do is just simply to protect the troops and to preserve some stability there. So, and I think, by the way, if you look at Mnuchin trying to pull money back from the Fed on the bailouts, if you look at placing people in all these agencies, one of Trump's main objectives right now is to sabotage the Biden administration. And, you know, sort of to create, you know, Trump's deep state, you know, people put in positions that can undermine it. Now, it could get worse. You know, Trump has put in his own guy as the chief counsel at the National Security Agency. He has got sort of hacks in at the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. And, you know, one of the things that you could see in these places is evidence of Trump wrongdoing being destroyed, being classified in ways that it can, you know, it becomes harder to get at it, and him covering his tracks. And so he can sabotage Biden, he can cover his tracks. Can he use it for a coup? I don't think so. I think, you know, General Milley and the other members of the United States Armed Forces have already indicated they're not for that. So really the question is, what damage can he do to Biden, and how can he impede the job of future prosecutors?
And how has this prolonged election affected the United States' position in the world?
It has weakened us. It's weakened us as a champion of democracy, but it's also raised a question. You know, I think there was a hope in the part of our allies that Trump would lose, he would be repudiated, you would get back to sort of normal with Joe Biden and a more traditional administration, and you'd be able to say, you know, the United States, it's the old United States. We're back, whatever its flaws, we're back to the old United States. But that didn't happen. Trump got 73 million votes.
Exactly.
Trump got more votes than any other candidate for president in American history other than Biden. The Republicans will keep the Senate in all likelihood. I hope they don't, but they will. They picked up a bunch of seats in the House. They picked up some state legislatures. They picked up one governorship. They weren't repudiated. The Trumpist, McConnellist, extremist Republican movement of the past few years is alive and kicking. And any foreign observer has got to look at this and say, when is it going to come back? What if the Republicans take back the House in 2022? What if this weakens Biden to the point that he can't get anything done, and you've got Trump or Trump Jr. or Tom Cotton or Mike Pompeo back in 2024? So I think the whole world is going to say, we're delighted to have Joe Biden there. We're delighted for 4 years of somewhat normal U.S. foreign policy. But we're going to take everything the U.S. does going forward with a grain of salt, until we show that we can put together 2, 3, 4, 5 administrations of stability in a row. I mean, I think we have to remember, the Bush administration was no prize either, as far as the world was concerned. Notably, you know, the catastrophe in Iraq. And the Obama administration was not terribly strong on foreign policy. So we've now had three administrations in a row, this whole century of either terrible foreign policy or weak foreign policy in which we were withdrawing from a leadership role. And so I just don't think the world's going to snap back. I think the Germanys and the Frances and the Chinas and the Russias are all trying to fill the void, not out of overweening ambition in some of their cases, but out of the recognition that a void in geopolitics invites disaster.
I don't mean to be too dramatic here, but I so remember that Herblock cartoon depicting the end of the British Empire and the sun going down. Is the sun going down on our democratic way of life?
I think the measured, responsible, and fact-based answer to that is we don't know, which in and of itself is heartbreaking and kind of nauseating. It kind of physically makes me ill. But we don't know, because if Trump succeeds in this effort, if he stays a factor, if the Republican Party continues and with the benefit of this new Supreme Court continues to undermine principles like one person, one vote, and gives hugely disproportionate power to the moneyed people in this country, if corruption remains the norm, U.S. white-collar political corruption, yeah, it's over. And by the way, the Constitution doesn't help things. The Constitution, you know, by 2040, 70% of the population of the United States is going to be concentrated in 16 states. That means that 30% of the population is going to be electing 68 senators. And that's ridiculous. It gives them an advantage in the electoral college. Those states are underpopulated, white, underperforming. Joe Biden counties, and he got a fraction of the counties that Trump did. Joe Biden counties produce 70% of America's GDP. Donald Trump counties produce 30%. So this group that has the most power is the least educated, is the most underperforming economically, is the most white, is the least tolerant. And our Constitution says we're going to give them two votes for every vote that the others have. And you know, we could have a long conversation here about it, but could we change the Constitution? No. Because what it requires is many of those states to go along and give up their power, which is all that they've got. So I don't think that's going to change. I think the prospects for U.S. decline, and I tend to be kind of an optimist, but the prospects for U.S. decline are worse right now than they have ever been.
I'd like to try to end on an up note. David, are there several things that Joe Biden could do to help bring back to the United States that sense of we are all in this together?
Yes, no question about it. And I think that's his instinct. I think he first has to begin with his own party. He's got to keep the centrists and the progressives both engaged. He has to have a big tent Democratic Party. And then I think he's got to go and he's got to reach out and he's got to say, look, red state America, you want jobs. We need infrastructure to create jobs. Let's invest in that together. You want jobs. We need to educate people to do that. So let's create free education for, you know, junior college across the country. If he, you know, can identify a few things like that and give some benefits to the red states, that'll help. I think if he creates this kind of diverse cabinet and an agenda that's attuned to a successor generation of leaders, one of the most important things he can do is mobilize young voters. You know, if 18 to 34-year-olds voted in the same way that other groups vote in the U.S. elections, I think that amounts to 5 or 10 million more votes. So the young have disenfranchised themselves. If they re-enfranchise themselves, they tend to disproportionately support more progressive policies. I think that can be helpful. And the final thing is kind of counterintuitive. The Republicans are scorched earth. They don't play by norms. They don't play nice. If the Democrats start, you know, with the traditional Democratic thing, like, you know, let's color within the lines here and let's compromise on everything, they are going to get hosed. That's what we saw that. And that's what happened in many, many key issues in the Obama administration. So I think the other thing that Biden's got to do is he's got to have some victories. He's got to play tough. He's got to say, we're not going to roll over for these scorched earth Republicans. We're gonna fight for democracy in the United States in every way that we can. And if that ultimately means in 2022, you pick up some Senate seats and DC can become a state, Puerto Rico can become a state, U.S. Virgin Islands can become a state, we can do some things that don't require constitutional amendments. If you can rebalance the courts, because you got to, in order to restore some balance into this system, that can help. So he's got to both, it's a balancing act. He's got to reach out. He's got to give something to the red states. He's got to balance between progressives and conservatives. And he's got to be tough. And he's got to look Mitch McConnell in the eye and say, two can play at that game, and I will burn you down if you decide that you are going to attack our democracy.
And on that note, we'll leave it. David Rothkopf, so good to be with you. Thank you so much.
Really nice to see you, Diane, and glad to have this conversation.
Thank you. That was David Rothkopf, host of Deep State Radio and CEO of the Rothkopf Group Media and Podcasting Company. His new book is titled Traitor, A History of American Betrayal from Benedict Arnold to Donald Trump. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've written in to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Allison Brody, and Sandra Baker. Our engineer this week is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. I hope you're taking good care of yourselves and those around you. I'm Diane Rehm.